Hey, good morning, everyone. It's great to see you. We are in our seventh week of being in the corona apocalypse, being in quarantine. The new normal, what we've been doing is I've been showing you on your screen our scripture verses for each Sunday. A quick good news announcement. It looks like the bishop, Bishop Holston, came out with some good news for all churches in the South Carolina state that we are able to go back to church on June 10th. So, technically June 14th. So June 10th is, I believe, a Wednesday. So June 14th is the official date that we're given to be back in in-person gathering worship. So that's such good news that we have gotten that news. So while that may be four Sundays from now, we will continue to do this virtual person gatherings. We'll be talking with a lot of the leadership at both churches on how we want to get back in doing church. So that being said, I again welcome you to today, sixth Sunday of the Easter season. And today, our epistle lesson is from Acts chapter 17, verses 22 through 31. And you should see that on the screen there. So let's hear what Luke has to tell us in Acts today. He says, Paul stood up in the middle of the council on Mars Hill. And again, this is from the Common English Bible. But he says, Paul stood up in the middle of the council on Mars Hill and said, "People of Athens, I see that you are very religious in every way. As I was walking through town and carefully observing your objects of worship, I found an altar with this inscription saying, 'To an unknown God.' What you worship as unknown, I now proclaim to you. God, who made the world and everything in it, is Lord of heaven and earth. He doesn't live in temples made with human hands, nor is God served by human hands as though he needed something, since he is the one who gives life, breath, and everything else. From one person, God created every human nation to live on the whole earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their lands. God made the nations so they would seek him, perhaps even reach out to him and find him. In fact, God isn't far away from any of us. In God we live, move, and exist. As some of your own poets said, we are his offspring. Therefore, as God's offspring, we have no need to imagine that the divine being is like a gold, silver, or stone image made by human skill and thought. God overlooks ignorance of these things in times past, but now directs everyone everywhere to change their hearts and lives. This is because God has set a day when he intends to judge the world justly by a man he has appointed. God has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead." Our gospel lesson continues with the gospel according to John, and he continues Jesus' words to his disciples before the passion. And he says in chapter 14, verses 15 through 21, continuing in the Common English Bible, he says, "If you love me," these are Jesus' words, "you will keep my commandments. I will ask the Father, and he will send another companion who will be with you forever. This companion is the Spirit of truth, whom the world can't receive because it neither sees him nor recognizes him. You know him because he lives with you, and he will be with you. I won't leave you as orphans. I will come to you. Soon the world will no longer see me, but you will see me. Because I live, you live too. On that day, you will know that I am in my Father. You are in me, and I am in you. Whoever has my commandments and keeps them loves me. Whoever loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love them and reveal myself to them." You know, some people go on retreats to get close to God. Other people plan a vacation. They take time off of work and get away from the daily routine in order to get in touch or back in touch with God. And you remember, you may remember in earlier sermons, or if you've talked with me, I've mentioned to you that I have a small cabin on the Petee River near the South Carolina, North Carolina border. And if you were to drive down that long dirt driveway through the woods to see it, you wouldn't think much of it once you saw it. Purchased in 1990 by my father for $1, love and affection from his mother, my grandmother. It's just an old cinder block house with jail bars covering the windows and the doors and a screened-in front porch overlooking the Petee River. And on the inside, if you walk in, is where all our old furniture and household essentials go and have gone to lay at rest. You know, growing up, my father would take me there to do various jobs, you know, cut the grass, fix the plumbing, check to see if the water heater was working, or, you know, God forbid we get there after winter to make sure that none of the pipes had frozen over and busted open. And that really seemed to be our biggest problem in our father-son enterprise. Although I loved working alongside my dad, it did seem that going to the cabin was always a trip to do manual labor. But to my dad, though, it was complete and utter bliss. It was work that he wanted to do. I remember he would say to me that it was his happy place. I never could really quite understand what he meant by that, but it was his happy place. Now, my father, a man for some time late in his career, worked on Wall Street and rubbed shoulders with Goldman Sachs Group. He would laugh and tell me those people who would yell and shout across this big boardroom table there and just corporate America, Wall Street, would never come close to having what he had had. He had had his happy place. Mentally, he would go to the cabin and find peace whenever he was being chewed out by some corporate execs. When he was home and not traveling on business, and you know, I was back home from school, he would ask me, "Son, when do you want to go to the cabin? I'm really missing it. I think we should go." And now that I've inherited it, I think I'm beginning to see what he saw and feel what he felt. The tug and pull of the everyday routine of life takes its toll, and you begin to lose the sense of God's presence in your life. And I think that the cabin was my dad's place of bliss simply because that's where he would go to spend time with God. Sitting there in the front porch, just rocking in the chairs that he had set up and just watching the Petee River flow. That's where he went to go in his mind. And literally, that's where he always loved to go to spend time with God. And as a pastor, it is usually assumed that that is what my job is, spending time with God. But just like anyone else with a job, pastors can, you know, sometimes lose themselves in the work and miss the sense of God's presence altogether completely. And as silly as it may sound, pastors can get so involved that there is not enough time to be with God. As my one of my professors who I love dearly, and the retired bishop of North Alabama Conference and the former dean of Duke Chapel once said, sometimes we're called to these times of voluntary disengagement by way of the Sabbath, by way of rest, retreat, meditation, subtraction, or sanctuary. He says, in such times we step back, take stock, reassess our lives, look at things from a new perspective. But just as there are times of voluntary disengagement, there are also times of involuntary disengagement. In other words, what I think he means is there are times in our lives when you know, the daily hustle and bustle is brought to a screeching halt. And those of you who are inclined to live everything planned out and everything is in control, during those times when you feel out of control, you don't do well when plans don't go accordingly. And in these times of involuntary disengagement, we didn't plan for our lives to be interrupted, but they were. And with time, and with the time that we're given, we have the rare opportunity to reassess, to learn a new and important truth. In these times of mandatory, involuntary retreats, we are made to retreat. Step back, take a look around at our lives, at ourselves, and reassess some things. You know, throughout my life, I've heard many stories of people who've had all kinds of near-death experiences, anything and everything from drug overdoses to car accidents. And I, for one, am no stranger to surviving near-death experiences with my being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and with wrecking my first vehicle. And I know that the mental reversal that those near-death experiences can have on your life, I mean, they had an effect on my life, you know, especially if the accident was extremely horrific. You know, it's as if we, once you cheated death, have woken up to what's really important to life. And it's really the best thing that could have ever happened to us, being woken up to what's important, to the truth. Even in those confined places of our lives, when we're trapped, when there's nowhere to escape, even in times, you know, like today, we're not in quarantine, we're pushed close to God and to what really matters in life. I'm reminded of all the key figures in history who found themselves not necessarily quarantined, but definitely in prison and confinement. I'm thinking about Paul's letters while he was imprisoned in Rome. Nearly half of the New Testament is written by Paul, the apostle. And I'm thinking of John in his book of Revelation while in exile on the island of Patmos. Those of you that were able to join me for Bible study know about that this past Wednesday. And I'm thinking about Martin Luther King Jr. and his letter from Birmingham, Alabama jail, or even Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and the many letters and papers that he wrote while in prison in Nazi Germany in World War II. But Eugene Peterson believes that in life there are also times of what he calls forced imprisonment. We go through some great loss, a loss of a job, loss of a loved one through death or divorce, or loss of freedom, you know, by being in prison. And all the loss of happiness that comes through the grieving process, it is like he says that we're in exile, as if we're being forced to move out of our accustomed home into an unaccustomed new place. Not that these circumstances, these loss that have happened, these circumstances in our life produce new life and good by themselves, but it is, he says, amazing how they can be the condition necessary for that new life. In other words, what I think Eugene Peterson is saying is, what we deem as a loss, God makes it abundant. You know, what we view as confinement and quarantine, God makes our minds and our souls free. What we consider dead and departed, God makes it revive and come alive. And that should give us hope. And that should find in us comfort for especially these times. You know, since the passing of my dad a couple years ago from a car accident, I bought my mom a book that had just recently come out by Duke Divinity Professor Kate Bowler. And it's a great book. If you ever get a chance, to read it. It's called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And in it, she chronicles her battle with stage 4 cancer while in search of the answers to life's hardest questions, like how to live life while facing death. Is there a master plan? Does everything happen for a reason? And does God never put more on us than we can handle? And this may be a spoiler alert to some of you that want to read it, but her conclusion is really profoundly simple, and it's that life is hard and life is beautiful. And it's fascinating how often life's difficulties and our faithful resilience as human beings to overcome them bring about our experiences of new beauty found only in the power and by the power of God. It takes time and space and a place for God to work in our lives. In a way, it's rather sad that we have to wait for this involuntary retreat to find it. Maybe this pandemic, this time off, says to us that we ought to be more intentional about seeking our times, our places, our opportunities for this practice of presence with God. Maybe in this pandemic, we've been shown that we, like I said earlier, are creatures full of resilience and hope, that no matter what life throws at us or where life takes us, God is close beside us and near us. Earlier in our readings of Acts chapter 17, Paul preaches to the Athenians to help them understand that the unknown God they worship is the God he knows very well. And he knows God well because that God is transcendently near to all, he tells them. Quoting one of their own, one of the Athenians' own poets, and accepting the same truth as that poet, saying, quoting him, "We are all God's offspring." But the problem, however, is that, as Paul tells them, and tells us, we don't know it. We don't know that we're God's offspring. We don't know our true identity as a beloved child of God. We don't even know that God is transcendently near to us. The point Paul makes, I think theologian Richard Lisher captures well. He says, God is so transcendently close, we can't see God. And so woven into the fabric and the fiber of things that God remains hidden. And it's like the key lost in plain view. Therefore, God is present even when we're unaware. God is present even when we can't seem to find God. God is present even in our sufferings. God is present in the helper, the advocate, the spirit of truth. And as the Common English Bible said, the companion. God is present even in the companion that walks alongside us when the world is in disbelief. So no matter where we are, the Holy is present with us. Even in these times of searching, of longing to be near to the presence of God during a global pandemic and quarantine, you know, we must be disciplined to question, is God near to us? And what is God doing now? Is this time of suffering also a time of a potential time with God? The Greek word for time has two words, kairos and chronos. That Greek word meaning God's time is kairos, and where time as we know it is chronos. And sometimes in suffering, there's a potential time of our time becoming God's time. In other words, is this involuntary time that has kind of just come about, sprung up on us, on the world, is this a time when God is setting us apart in order to get closer to us? I'd like to think so. I'd like to think so. And I'd like to think that Paul affirms this, that God is getting close to us in this pandemic when he says what he says in Acts chapter 7. He says, God, who made the world and everything in it, is Lord of heaven and earth. He doesn't live in temples and churches made with human hands, nor is God served by human hands as though he needed something from us. Since God is the one who gives life, God is the one who gives breath and everything else. From one person, Adam, God created every human nation to live on the whole earth, and having determined their appointed time and the boundaries of their lands, God made the nations so they would seek after him, perhaps even reach out to him and find him. In fact, God isn't far away from any of us, Paul says. He goes on to say, in God we live, in God we move, in God we exist. And as some of your own poets, Athenians, as some of you have said before, we are his offspring. Therefore, as God's offspring, we have no need to imagine that the divine being is like anything constructed, anything made by gold or silver, or anything that you construct by stone and an image, anything that you construct by human skill and thought. God overlooks ignorance of these things in times past, but now directs everyone everywhere to do something meaningful and deeper with their lives, to change their hearts and their lives. This is because God has set a day when he intends to judge the world justly by a man named Jesus, whom he had appointed. And God has given proof of this to everyone by raising this person, Jesus, from the dead. So with Paul's words, we can find hope and put trust that God is not only transcendent, but is also very close and near to us always because of the words also that John tells us through the man God appointed for resurrection. Jesus tells his disciples in John, don't worry, I will be with you. Trust me. If you love me, then keep my commandments. The greatest one of these to love one another. And I'll also send another companion, a helper who will be with you forever. God will send you this companion, the Spirit of truth, whom you know because he lives with you and will be with you forever. And you always know that I'll be with you, but I will not leave you without guidance. I will not leave you without guidance to love one another. I will come back to you. I will come to you, come very near to you to help you. And soon the world will no longer see my love, but you who believe in me will see my love because my love is in you. I am in you. I live in you. And on that day that you believe in me and see the love that is in you from me, on that day you will know that I am from God and that you belong to me and I belong to you. If you love me, you will keep my commandments, the greatest to love one another. And if you love me, you will be loved by my Father, and I will love in return and reveal myself to you. So in other words, the presence of God, Jesus Christ, and the companion are all revealed near to us simply through love. And by grace and by that love of God, God is taking us into our happy place, which is the very life of God. Not only is God near to us, but we also live in God and God lives in us. So we have been invited to enter into the very heart of God's life. We come from God. We come from the God of love. We are love's offspring, and we find our truest identity in relationship to God as children of God, becoming who we are meant to be. Now, at this moment, we should see in Jesus our destiny to live forever in God's life, to live in the very heart of God's happy place. And that's good news indeed for all of us. Amen.